You are listening to the Massive Report podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Massive Report podcast, or what we're doing as the Massive Report podcast right now. If you've missed the last couple of shows, we've transitioned from talking about the crew as much as we were because, let's face it, there hasn't been soccer here for the last month almost. And we've had various guests on to talk about how they got involved with the crew, how they got involved in our case with Massive Report, you know, people we think would be interesting to share some stories and whatnot. So we've done a few of these already. And today we have Jonathan Smith with us. You may know him as T-Bone, Degenerate T-Bone, Smitty, if you go back far enough. You're a man who has a lot of names, Jonathan. How you doing?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me on, Pat. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And before we get into soccer stuff and Mass Report stuff, obviously this coronavirus has affected everybody. How are you and your family holding up? I know there's a few of you in the house. You just moved recently. How's that all been for you guys?
Yeah, we bought a house right before a pandemic, and so closing and all that was a little hairy, but
I can imagine.
It worked out in that way. I mean, obviously it's, you know, our situation, we have nothing bad happening right now. Everybody we know is good and healthy. Everybody in our house healthy. We have three little girls. The oldest is 9. The youngest is 6 months. So two of them are doing online schooling, and then we just have a, you know, 6-month-old who, you know, has her moments. So yeah, it's been a little different. My wife works out of the house. I mean, she's a stay-at-home mom, so she still works, obviously, but not in the same way she used to work in the corporate world.
Right.
So she's been like A+, just stepping up with teaching and dealing with all the, you know, classwork that they have and all that stuff. And so, yeah, I've been working from home too, doing a radio show from 3 to 6. So that isn't easy for her either, because she's trying to keep the kids out somewhat quiet so we can, but it, you know, it's pretty amazing because I hear them stomping around up there sometimes, and I'm in a basement, and yet not a lot of that gets through on the air. So it's worked out okay. And I'm lucky enough that, you know, work for a place that lets me do that. So certainly understand that not everyone gets to, and it sucks for the people who have to, you know, still go out, but we appreciate everybody who's doing the essential services stuff, because I know that's a grind, and it's especially tough, you know, under the circumstances we're all in. So
for sure. You mentioned working with the fan. For people that don't, you know, obviously you guys have still been on the air. We hear you guys. How has it worked? What kind of equipment did they have to set you up with? How does that all work to do it from home?
I should have grabbed the equipment. It's just right over there, but it's a box that's, you know, that big maybe. And it's like thousands of dollars a piece of equipment, but.
So they trust you.
Yeah. Well, they gave one of those to about everybody that works at the station. So okay. You start doing the math on that. I mean, it's quite the investment, but they were committed to making sure everybody got to work from home if they could. And they sent us home with microphones and cables and this machine. It's called a codec, and you plug in, like, you get the Ethernet cable. You can do Wi-Fi, and then it does the rest. I just hit like a button, and then I hit another button that is the signal I'm supposed to be on. And then somehow at this radio station, there's a thing that receives all that and it converts it into whatever they need to convert it to. And then our producers put it up on the board, and then they play it just like any other, you know, you're familiar with an audio board, any other source like a microphone or a computer audio or anything else. So yeah. And then there's a little delay. So it's weird because I don't see my co-host, and usually I can see him. I can kind of tell when we're wrapping something up, or I can tell when he's laughing, you know, like visually I can see he's smiling or something, or he's, you know, frowning or whatever. And you kind of read those cues. Doing it without any of that is a little difficult, but you know, we've been working together for 9 years now. Yeah. So we kind of know when things are working and when you know, we're kind of ready to abandon a subject and move on. So it's grand scheme of things, it's not very difficult. It's been pretty easy. So yeah, we're lucky we have a good team at the Fan that helps us out with that. So
is anyone actually on site at the Fan right now, or is it everybody's remote?
Yeah. So our producers are on site. So okay. they're going in. They had a plan though to put them offsite and have them work at home, but it would have made things a lot more clunky. And they kind of have, I think, set up the producers, at least some of them, with their own studios, so they can come in, it's all clean.
Yeah.
They can keep it clean, they can leave, and they don't have a lot of cross contamination. I mean, we have four producers,
right,
you know, that produce all the radio shows. So but like our salespeople are working from home, our audio guy who does all of our commercials that you hear and all that production, he's working from home. We're like doing the Zoom meeting thing like everyone else is, like we're doing now.
Yeah.
There's like 40 people on it, and we do get a little face to face that way. But yeah, I mean, we're doing the best, you know, to just try to, you know, keep morale up and stuff. And it is, most people are pretty, you know, morale's good. It's just, you know, like everyone else, there's challenges to it, but we're making it work. So we're pretty lucky. No complaints here.
Yeah. All right, let's get into what we brought you on to talk about and the crew. And, you know, obviously I don't know if people, you know, some newer fans of the crew, some newer fans of Mass Report may not know you were one of the original, I believe, people involved with Massive Report. But before we get into that, soccer, the crew, all that, how did you first get involved with the sport? What led you to become a crew fan? Kind of take us through your history with the sport and this team.
Yeah. So I was for sure I looked at the crew. I was around in the early, you know, part of crew existence in the late 90s. You know, I would go to, I've been to games at Ohio Stadium. I went to a game, I think, in the first year of Crew Stadium, but obviously, like, at the time I went, it was not like this sacred moment for me. It was just, it was like anything else. It was back in the day, there were Chill games to go to, there were Crew games to go to, there were, you know, Clippers games you would go to. Columbus Horizon was like, yeah, a basketball team we used, yeah, to have for a hot minute. So it was just one of the things that I got to do when I was in like high school that, you know, my dad got tickets, then we'd go, and, you know, I enjoyed it, but I didn't know enough about the sport to really dive into what was going on. It was just like a fun night out. And then it was in 2002 with the World Cup, the crew had viewing parties.
Right.
And, you know, so I was at home, like still living at home. I had just finished my freshman and only year at Ohio State, but I was working at a radio station where I worked pretty late hours. I worked till like midnight. And so I had a buddy who was home from college, and my brother was still in high school. And another one of my buddies also, there's four of us that was back from college too. So there's four of us, and everyone else but me was a big soccer fan. My brother played in high school, and the other guys played too, and then they followed the sport pretty hardcore. So that was the World Cup that was in Japan and Korea, South Korea. So all the games were like 2 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning. So the crew had the tent, the big white tent that, you know, they still have stuff in. That was like the viewing party central. And you would go there at 2 o'clock in the morning, and there'd be 100 cars, 200 cars in the parking lot, and walk in, they'd have free snacks, they'd have free Pepsi products, I remember.
Yeah.
Like coolers, just giant barrel-sized coolers of them all over the place. You just get whatever you wanted. But I thought, you know, as like a kid in college, I was like, this is awesome. Especially, I grew up a church kid too, so I didn't like drink or anything back then. And that was like, oh my gosh, this, you know, that was like free beer to me. I thought that was great. So, but then we would get there a little early to watch. We wanted to watch U.S. soccer and watch the U.S. national team. But we'd also watch with like some of the other fan bases, because it was open for every game, not just right. U.S. soccer games. And so you'd see fans from, you know, whatever team was in it, France or, you know, I don't even remember which teams all were in it, but you'd see like there'd be a decent amount, 30, 40 people who'd show up completely decked out, faces painted, flags. And we sat there and watched with them for like the second half of the game or something. And you'd start to pick up on their chants and kind of see what they were watching. And that was the first time I watched soccer in a way that got me to understand, oh, there's things to get riled up about that aren't necessarily he missed a goal. Oh man, that sucks. Or,
right.
Oh, he committed a stupid foul. That sucks. You know, it was the pass before the pass and some of that, you know, stuff like setting up a movement. Why didn't the guy make a run? You know, these are the things I started to kind of catch in that month that we were going to that. And we went, I think, to every U.S. soccer game. We started just going on random nights when we were all free to, you know, go check it out. So, and then after that, and Brian McBride was on that team. So that was like a guy who was playing that I knew because I knew if you went to a crew game, you knew Brian McBride.
Yeah.
And he was on that national team and he scored some big goals, scored the third one against Portugal. Yeah, so he was great.
Scored against Mexico.
Yeah, scored against Mexico. And so that started me kind of realizing like, oh, wow, this is like the world stage. Look at all these people who care about this. And there's a guy who's like, I could watch anytime I want and I haven't been paying attention. And so that kind of got me to realize the importance of, yeah, why don't I go support this team? It's professional. It's here. And you've got world-class talent playing here.
Yeah.
At least in Brian McBride's case and certainly a few others too. But so that was what got me into it. And so then we started going to more games and yeah, it was, I think after that, 2005, 2006, where I really, you know, had some disposable income and I bought season tickets and started meeting up with some of the different supporters groups that formed around that time, Hudson Street Hooligans being the main one. And yeah, so then the Nordeca happened and it all just kind of steamrolled from there. But so the 2002 World Cup is probably my big introduction to soccer. And yeah, that was a fun time.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, maybe not necessarily the 2002 World Cup, but I think if you ask a lot of American soccer people, a World Cup tends to be something that opened, unless there's somebody who grew up playing soccer and, you know, was in love with it as a kid, you know, a World Cup, similar stories, they got taken to a bar or an event like that. And I think a lot of people in Columbus would point to those games down at Crew Stadium because there were, I mean, I remember the US-Mexico game, the US-Germany game, it was packed.
Yeah, the Germany game, I want to say they had people in the stadium.
Yeah.
Because they completely packed out the tent. And I want to say they had a few thousand people watching on the Jumbotron in the stadium.
Right.
And I think that was at like 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it was pretty early. I remember that.
I remember it being dark. And I remember like walking up and seeing people in the stadium. Or maybe I stepped outside because we got in and we were in the tent. And then I saw people were in the stadium. And I'm like, people are like, wow, that's how many people are here? Because we got there early to make sure we got a seat.
Right.
I still remember that too. I think it was one of the furniture stores, maybe Value City or somebody, had like put couches
and
TVs all around the tent. And so like if you got there early, you could sit on a leather couch for like the whole thing. And it was sublime. It was just fantastic. But
yeah, for the final, I remember sitting like in one corner of the tent, they had a big TV. And I remember getting there early enough to sit on one of the couches in like that corner. I was very excited about that. But
yeah, those are the primo seats. For sure.
Yeah. And I, like I said, I think a lot of people would have somewhat of a similar story. Maybe it doesn't eventually bring you to the crew, but just, you know, gets you involved with U.S. soccer and kind of goes from there. From there, what was your connection that brought you into Massive Report and doing stuff for the site as it first started?
So by that point, I was working in radio I started right after the, actually, like I said, I was working that summer where I went to the World Cup, I was starting to work in radio. And then a few years later, I was more like, you know, secure in my position and had some, you know, little bit of disposable income. I got married. And so then I was going to games pretty regularly. And I started, I had a little soccer blog. I don't even remember what it was called, but it was something, one of the, I know like a million crew fans who've had, you know, a soccer blog.
Right.
I had written a few things. And I don't, again, I wish I remembered what the name of the site even was. I don't. But all I remember is that it was like a Blogspot account.
Yeah.
You know, it was nothing. But Steve Cirk apparently had seen a couple things I wrote at some point. I don't remember if it was for that or maybe I wrote on someone else's site. And so when the guy who was starting to run Massive Report, and the guy who started kind of all of Massive Report, was looking for different guys. As I remember it, he said that like Circuit recommended, you know, hey, if you're looking for a guy, this is a guy who, you know, has written a few things and thought it would be worth my time to go over there. And yeah, so that was how I kind of got connected and hooked up and, you know, met Patrick and Sammy and everybody else. I kind of knew Sam before that, but Sam also helped. He recommended me, Sam Palmy. Yeah. So, yeah. And then from there, it was, I think every day I was hanging out with those guys, whenever we would meet up, it's like, we got to do a podcast. And they were like, yeah, yeah, we should, some point. And then eventually we got to a point, I think it was after the first year, where it was like, all right, now let's actually try to do a podcast. And then we got that kind of started up. And Matt Goschert, who was there at the time, and Chris Lamacchia, those guys were big helps. And they, and Sam, obviously, you know, I mean, there's everything at Massive Report, Sam is a big help with. So he's had his fingerprints on everything. So yeah, so those guys were kind of the ones who also were there to help kind of push it along and get it started. So yeah, it was good.
I think it's interesting talking to, you know, we started, Sam and I did one of these where we both kind of shared our stories. And then last week we did one with Patrick Golden, who you mentioned. But when we talk about the podcast, you know, nowadays everyone has a podcast, right? You know, it's everywhere. At that point, that wasn't the case though. That was kind of the early stages of podcasts, right? You guys were, there weren't seven crew podcasts at that point.
There were only like 22, I think. And now, no. But, it was something though that I remember thinking we're behind, you know.
Okay.
And now I still feel like, you know, no matter what I'm doing, I'm always like, we're behind. We got it, you know. So maybe that's just my personality. But, yeah, it definitely wasn't the same as it was, you know, 5 years after that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, where almost every team had a podcast and almost every team had, a, you know, 18 different blogs that wrote about it. I think the crew, for whatever reason, maybe because it's the oldest team and because you just have a lot of interesting things that have happened to this club, I think it's just, there's a lot of people who got into the crew quickly who just happened to be involved in some kind of media or had some kind of passion for trying to do something with it. And I think there is a bit of the fact that Ohio State at the time and still does dominate the coverage on the media side, that there are people who say, yeah, well, how do I get something that just eliminate, I know where I can get that stuff, but where's the focus content on just the stuff, the crew stuff that I want to, you know, when I want to nerd out on that, or if I'm a diehard crew fan. And at the time, I think there was such a void of not any one entity had really stepped up. And that's where people kind of said, well, why don't I try? And, you know, you had the big soccers of the world that
was
kind of like the epicenter for that for a while. And, you know, now there's obviously more outlets, you know, which is good. It's good that big soccer exists too, but Twitter and all that helps as well to just have outlets. But yeah, I think that's part of it.
You mentioned the cast of characters that were involved, Matt and Chris and Sam, you know, and obviously there's been a lot of people that have taken part in the Massive Report podcast over the years. I imagine you probably have some stories with those guys. Anything you can, anything that jumps out that you can share about kind of the early days of this podcast?
Yeah, well, I remember we recorded like, I don't know if it was the first episode. It was one of the first, I think it was the first, I could be wrong. But we recorded the very first episode, if I'm not mistaken, at the defunct Hooligans bar that was running at the time. And that was going to be like the home base for this, or at least that for that one podcast it was. So I remember we were like sitting around a table and Sam was like, let's get some action shots of you guys talking. And I know what he meant, but I remember thinking like action shots of a podcast, it may be the most like ill coined term ever. Cause there's no action when you're recording a podcast, not usually, you're just sitting there talking. So we just sat there and we're like, and just making stupid faces. So some of those pictures exist somewhere, but yeah, I remember that we, for a long time, recorded and did the podcast at Fido down at Easton. And that was always a challenge because Fido, if you've ever, if anybody's been in there would know, it's a beautiful spot. It is not the biggest bar, but it's set up the way like a traditional pub you would expect is set up, which means it has like 27 different little cubby holes, rooms, and all this cool architecture and cool little, you know, nooks and crannies. But when you're trying to cram in, you know, 30 or 40 people to listen to a podcast, because we would have people come out and, you know, be a part of that, it was like, there's a guy over there hanging off the rafters, and there's a guy over here who's like sitting right next to you. Then there's, you know, it was kind of interesting. But we did at one point get Guillermo Barros-Skeloto and Gino Padula to come on at the same time, and that was probably one of my favorite episodes, just because those, that was after they, you know, won MLS Cup and everything else. So it was kind of cool to see those two, as their friendship at the time was pretty strong. It was great to kind of meet those guys, have them come on, and, you know, we were all just like, whatever Guillermo said, we all just laughed, and we're like, yeah, right, you know, because we're like, can't believe you're here, man. It was a lot of the Chris Farley sketch with him and Paul McCartney. Like, yeah. Remember that time when you won the cup? That was great. Sure, our interview was terrible, but we just loved, you know, getting to meet those guys. And yeah, so that was a cool place to do it. That was fun.
Did you guys have to go through the team to get them to come out, or how did that all get set up? Do you know?
We had a pretty strong connection with Duncan. So Duncan would come on quite frequently. He was on one of our first episodes and actually was kind of like a guest host, like a serial guest host who was just on a lot. Whenever he could, he would swing down and of course would say stuff that probably shouldn't have.
Right.
Like just team stuff, you know, stuff you're not supposed to let out there. He would tell us. And so I can't remember if Duncan set some of that up or if we did go through the team. Cause I don't recall setting a lot of that up. So I'm guessing whoever did set it up, it might have been through Duncan.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't remember how that all got set up. But yeah, that was back in the days, I think, of like Dave Stephanie, who was, you know, still is a solid dude. He's a real good guy and always great to work with. So
yeah, it's funny to think about that from my perspective now. You know, we want to have guests on the podcast or talking to guys. You know, it's always through the team, and there's obviously more podcasts, more people covering it now. So there's more requests. So it's not always as easy as just like, hey, come out to the bar tonight. You know, there's a whole setup to it. So it's funny how it's evolved. And obviously, you know, that happens with the course of the league and the growth of it and whatnot. You would expect those type of things, but just funny to hear those early stories that, you know, these guys just come out to the bar and, you know, do whatever they want.
Well, and that was, I mean, for people who wonder why do Crew fans love Duncan Outen so much, or why do they gravitate to Frankie Haydick so much? You know, like, why do the fans from that 2008 era or before, or slightly before, you know, why do you gravitate to those guys so much? And I'm sure you've heard these. I mean, I know you have, Pat, but, like, there's a lot of people maybe who aren't aware of just how, like, Duncan would show up at your bar. Like, the hooligan guys, he became really good friends with Grant Thurman and some of the other guys who kind of started that group, to the point that some of those guys were in his wedding or were going to be in his wedding. I think he had a destination wedding. They couldn't make it, but and he was in there. Like, it's just, they had a super strong connection. So it was nothing to go to Ruby Tuesday, the bar, not the restaurant, down there on campus. And you'd walk in and see a couple Hudson Street guys and a couple Crew players, and they're talking nothing about the games.
Yeah.
They're just shooting the breeze about whatever else is going on. And so that was and Siggy would come over there. Siggy Schmidt would be there. So back then it was just more of, and I'm not saying that's right or wrong. It's just, how can you blame people for developing a strong connection to that? Right. I mean, it's, you know, even if you only get to do that once, you're going to have that memory for a long time. So that was, I think, part of just the way things were back then. And it sounds so weird because it's not like we're talking about the 50s.
You know,
we're talking about like 12 years ago. Yeah. But, you know, that's how, I mean, in fairness, that's how much MLS has grown. Because you're right, it would be weird if, like, you know, Chicharito just showed up. Well, if Chicharito showed up anywhere around the team, because I don't think he even who's fully aware who he plays for, you know, but you know what I mean? Like these right. stars, a lot of these guys now they're much bigger stars. It would be odd to see them just showing up at a bar. So I get it. It's not like a knock on that, but yeah, back then there was a lot, it was a lot easier to get guys on that podcast because they were just around. And if you talked to the right, if you had the right buddy who had an in with Duncan, or if you had the right, you know, you could twist someone's arm and get them to come on your show. And yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. And I think there's still some, to some level in MLS, and especially in a city like Columbus, where, you know, a lot of these guys are still just guys, you know, the Hector Jimenez's of the world and stuff, where, you know, you'll see these guys out from time to time and they're fine to chat for a minute and things like that. You know, it's not like the NFL where if you happen to be at a bar where Julio Jones is, for lack of a better term, he's in the VIP and you're not. Now there are, you know, I don't know Lucas Zelarayan's party habits, but I imagine he's a little, you know, a step above what the average crew fan would be doing on a Saturday night. But it was back then.
That's an interesting point too, because that is one of the many, I know we'll probably get to this at some point, but that's one of the many things that's so frustrating about this year is that I was so excited to watch him and Darlington Nagbe and Vito and all the new additions.
Yeah.
We got to see a glimpse of it and then it's all gone, you know, yeah. Or at least it's on pause. I mean, it's not all gone obviously, but I thought there was going to be a lot of momentum based on what this team could do. So I'm, you know, we want to be safe. We want everything to, you know, a lot of other important things that have to happen before that. But I really want to find out what Lucas Zelarayán can do on the field. I want to, you know, I don't know. I'm curious to see how this city gravitates to a player that I think of his caliber, I think he could be. But, you know, that's all on hold right now. And that's understandable, of course.
Yeah. Well, since you brought it up, let's jump into a little bit about your thoughts on this year, because, you know, there were a lot of people after the way last season went that were, you know, upset with Caleb Porter and things like that. You know, obviously the end of last year was much better once they kind of got healthy and things like that. But, you know, it wasn't exactly, you know, not everyone had a consensus that this was going to be a great team this year. Yes, there were additions, but a lot of people were curious about why Caleb was bringing back guys from the Portland team. And, you know, not everyone had seen Zelarayán play. In fact, most people probably hadn't. So, you know, even when we did our preseason predictions, we had quite a bit of fluctuation. You got to see two games. What were your impressions coming in the year, and what did you take out of those two games?
Yeah, I kind of thought that, you know, if the crew were able to get 4 points out of the first two games, you know, I'd be pretty thrilled with that, because they're playing, you know, one of the best teams in the East in New York City and, you know, the defending champs on the road. So I thought 4 points would be, you know, pretty good. Overall for this season, I kind of thought it might take them 5 or 6 weeks to really find their footing, because as much as people want to say, and I was one of the people saying, Caleb Porter has to make the playoffs this year at minimum, or it's going to be real hot on his seat. I'm not saying the Haslams would do anything, or that, you know, the ownership would do anything, but for fans, I mean, it would be almost criminal if this team didn't make the playoffs prior to the situation we're now in.
Yeah.
Who knows what's going to happen with that. But, you know, I think that was my expectation going into the season, was that this team would probably take a few weeks to gel. There'd probably be some, you know, there'd probably be a game where they drop something like 3-0. And everybody would lose their minds, rightfully so, to a degree, right? I mean, that's just bound to happen.
Right.
But I was willing to give it like 6 to 8 weeks, kind of get into May, June. And then I was expecting I would see a team that was a little more gelled, that Zelarayán would find his footing. I was like fully prepared for him to take a while to get going, for Nagbe to take a while, you know. And then through the first two games, I don't know. I thought Zelarayán, at least in the first game, I thought he was – pretty great. He had his moments.
Yeah.
You know, in the second game, I'm trying to remember back to it, because I watched that at a friend's house and we were drinking a little bit more, so I wasn't locked in. But no, I remember both of them being dangerous, you know, Darlington and him, but in different ways. I think Nagbe is such a good connector. So yeah, I had a lot of hopes for this year, and I still do, if they can play it, or to whatever level they can play it.
Right.
I'm very curious to see how MLS, they have such a weird scenario because NBA and NHL can just go to their playoffs and kind of try to limp through and get that done and get a champion. And so same for world soccer, almost every league is the same boat. Major League Baseball never started. So they have the ability to say, well, this season maybe doesn't exist, you know, if it goes that way, or we can play some real shortened, weird thing. And I don't know. MLS is such a weird dynamic because they did start barely, but they started. So I don't really know how you handle that. I mean, you come back, let's say they can come back in July, you know, which games do you cut out? You know, how do you just start from there? Do you only play your conference opponents right. and just wash out all the other, you know, I don't know. It's going to be the good news is like as fans we're if they can get back, we'll at least have something to watch on TV. Who knows if we can actually watch them in the stadiums. That's a whole nother thing, but yeah. So my expectations were playoffs or bust. And I don't know, after two games, I didn't feel anything that was derailing that after two games, but I don't think I would.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. You bring up about what they'll do. You know, I talked to Bez a couple weeks ago now, maybe a few weeks ago now, short beginning of when this all started, and you know, his hope, and I think this everyone's hope, was that they would be able to fit all of the games in. Obviously you were going to have to truncate the season to some degree, but they felt that there was enough, you know, window. Now obviously the longer this goes on, the smaller the chances that happens. So it'll be very interesting to see what, you know, what the approach is. You mentioned a couple options there, but you know, if, for instance, if you don't, now the Crew weren't playing the Galaxy, for instance, but if you go to conference only, you lose a lot of the appeal of teams traveling to, you know, Chicharito was going to play in a bunch of stadiums, for instance, and that was going to attract fans and whatnot. Yeah. And, you know, it is what it is because no one saw this coming and there's nothing you can do, but, you know, it would certainly affect things, you know, financially and whatnot if you only get certain games. And I mean, the Crew obviously and the teams around the league probably had marketing campaigns set for certain teams coming to town and whatnot. So
I'm sure there is a list of this, and you may know it, you may not off the top of your head. There's got to be a few teams that never even got to play their home opener, right?
Because oh yeah, for sure.
There's usually quite a few teams that are 2 weeks or more before they get to play their home openers. So yeah, I know Miami, right? Isn't
yeah. Yeah.
Did they play? Did they get to do that? I don't know.
No, I think because they played at DC and then
– yeah, I can't remember who their second game was.
Or maybe it was at LAFC. Yeah, at LAFC the first game and then at DC the second game.
Yeah, I remember watching the DC game. So, so they didn't get to have a home.
Yeah, run. I think they were still a week or so away from even doing that. And I assume there are a few other teams that didn't get to play a home game. Just the way this
season. And again, I mean, it's worth pointing out again, no one is saying this is not justified. I mean, it totally is, but we're talking about soccer. We're just, you know, as soccer fans opining about how much it's not fun, but I get it. You get it. I know. But yeah, I'm really interested, not just with that, but all of, you know, sports to see where they fit in once all this kind of, once we get to a point where people can start getting back to normal life or whatever normal life looks like. But obviously Major League Soccer has a role to play in that. So, you know.
Looking back Crew history wise, you mentioned you kind of really started to get into it after that World Cup. Are there memories? I'm sure there are, that, you know, games, things that happened, that particularly stand out to you, and maybe some that aren't, you know, the 2008 MLS Cup or things that everyone thinks of, but like things that for one reason or another, you, when you think of Crew history, you point to that game or that moment or things like that.
Yeah, I definitely remember, like, I remember odd things from seasons. I remember one of the first guys that I started watching with intent when I would go to games that wasn't, you know, Brian McBride
or
some of the other big name guys. Was, I remember John Wilmar Perez was a guy that, like, my brother would say, you've got to pay attention to what he's doing. He's really good with moving off the ball and you know, he gets the ball on his feet. He can do a lot of good things. And I remember at first I was just watching him like, he doesn't score any goals. I don't know what he's so excited about. And then it was another one of those, like, pay attention to what the game is actually doing, not just what the end result is, you know, like pay attention to the process. And that's where I started. He was one of the first guys I remember watching and like, oh, yeah, well, he did set that guy up and that guy just kicked it right over the bar. Or, oh, man, he had that. That was a good pass. The guy was offside by like a hair.
Yeah.
And you start to see, oh, there is a little more class here than what was initially, you know, what I initially understood. So he was a guy that I remember definitely sticking out. I also remember it's probably the 2007 season, might have been 2006. And I know it was one of those 2 years because I had season tickets and I was sitting in the end where the stage is now. And it was a game, I want to say it was FC Dallas or, yeah, whenever they became FC Dallas. Might have been before that. But I think it was Dallas. And I know it was a torrential downpour. And it was just, like, we'd go under the stands, we'd come back out. I think they called the game, they stopped the game a couple times. By the end of it, all I know is it was me, my brother, and these like six or seven guys who were just shirtless and yelling and everybody was soaked. But they were like five rows behind the goalkeeper and they were just giving it to whoever it was. I can't even remember. But so we were like, well, let's go down and stand with those guys. And we started talking and they were like, yeah, so we live off Hudson Street and we walk over here and – We like the name like Hudson Street Hooligans. We kind of like call ourselves that. And that was like the first time me and my brother met the guys who ended up being one of those groups. And then that was it must have been 2006 because the next year I remember we sat with them on purpose and we kind of like, they made t-shirts. We'd go to Ruby Tuesday with those guys and, you know, get together before the games. And so that's how we kind of became a part of the Hudson Street group. And I remember bringing buddies of mine with, and it was like we unlocked a whole new world for them when they would get to see that stuff. Because they were like, I didn't know you could have this much fun at a soccer game. I'm like, right? This is for us, you know, being like slightly out, you know, early 20s guys, we were like in heaven. We were just making fun of, you know, the keeper or whoever was down there, and just it was fun. And then when they said they had to move the Nordeca, you know, that was where that all became a different thing, but it was good and it was fun. But yeah, I remember that game. It was rain soaked, and I want to say it was Dallas, where there was like, by the end of it, no one left except for the diehards of diehards. And that's where I kind of started to say, am I a diehard? Did I cross? Because I usually would have left that, but it was just, we were having a blast listening to these guys make fun of the opposing team. And that was kind of what kept my interest. And then, you know, started to sit with them. So.
Yeah, I think I remember that game. I was trying to look up here that goalkeeper. I want to say his name started with a B, but I can't find it here.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
That's the sad thing is I should remember this stuff. I can remember like the broad strokes, but little details escape me constantly. So.
Yeah, John Wilmar Perez. It's funny you said that. We were talking recently. One of the guys wants to do a story about you know, kind of like cult heroes and guys that, you know, maybe not every fan thinks of, but guys that, you know, maybe had their moment where everyone got super excited about them or, you know, various things like that. And one of the guys I suggested was Perez. He was, he's a guy I think at that point in MLS was probably one of the better players in the league that was underappreciated for what he was able to do. I think back like 2002 US Open Cup semifinal, I believe I was trying to look that up too, but I can't find a box score of it. But I believe he had like two assists when the Crew came from behind in Kansas City and one, I think it went to extra time and one there. And yeah, there's a lot of things about him that stand out as like that first real attacking midfielder type that they had, you know, and they'd had other good midfielders, but he was like that kind of foreign, had the little bit of flair type of player.
I remember, so this is another odd story about him.
Yeah.
I remember being in a grocery store and there was a guy in front of me in line who had like workout shorts and soccer socks and the slides And I remember, like, this dude had, like, the largest calf muscles I'd ever seen in my life. And I was just like, that doesn't look healthy. Like, how are you? That's it's crazy how big his legs are. It's just something you notice, right? And then I also noticed in his cart, he had, like, 20 pounds of chicken. And just, like, an insane amount of, like, proteins and veggies. And, I mean, it was stocked full. And he was, like, a short little guy, and he was bald. And my brother was with me for whatever reason. We were getting, Lord knows, Mountain Dew or something to play video games. I don't know. But we were – so he says something at the end. He said something in Spanish to this guy, just like, you know, adios and, like, I don't know, Dios le bendiga or something, like, good luck, I'll be with you, something. And the guy looked back and he said, oh, yeah. And my brother goes, go Crew. And he's like, ah, and kind of smiled. And then that was it. And I'm like, who is – and he's like, that's John Wilmar Perez. And I was like, who's that? And he's like explaining to me who this was. And then later, you know, I watched him. He's like, remember that guy we met in line at the grocery store? This is him. And I'm like, okay. And that was just, again, it was one of those things that in a weird way, it did both, right? It like made me more interested in the Crew, but it also at points made me think like, oh, well, this isn't that big of a deal because you're not going to run into like Derek Jeter at the grocery store, you know, like, or, you know, like, so, but then as you go to these games, it's like, well, who cares if he's not Derek Jeter? Who cares if he's not, you know, one of these big Michael Jordan? It's like, he's one of the best players on our team. And none of those guys wear something that says Columbus on it. Well, Jeter did at one point. He wore Clippers uniform for a hot second, but yeah, you know, just that was kind of one of the moments where I realized like, who cares if it's not the best guys in the world? They're good and they're fun to watch and they're right here. Why not go watch them?
Yeah. You sort of already touched on this with the podcast and having guys on, but do you have any moments from a media perspective, so to speak, where you know, maybe got the opportunity to do things you wouldn't have normally gotten to do when it comes to the team, or, you know, maybe stories that people wouldn't know just from being a casual fan or whatnot?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things that jump to mind. One of them involves my own stupidity, and one of them involves... Okay. So when I worked at the first radio station where I worked, we had the opportunity to talk to Clint Dempsey because the All-Star game was coming to town. Was that like 2005?
I think they had it in 2001 and 2006, I want to say, because they had it...
It would have been the 2006 game. Okay. And I want to say... Deuce was still here. It was like right before he left and went to England. But he was one of the guys coming in. And so I remember like my PD who knew nothing, program director who knew nothing about sports or anything, was like, hey, there's this guy I guess you can interview. He's just a dude who plays for like New England or something. And I'm like, oh, okay. Why do they want it? And he was like, well, the All-Star game. And I said, oh, right. Who is it? And he's like, I don't know. Dempsey something or other. And I'm like, Clint Dempsey? Like, yeah, I want to talk to him. So I don't know if our audience, because it was like a Christian music station.
Right.
I don't know if our audience cared about Clint Dempsey coming to town, but I made sure that I got to talk to him because I thought that was kind of cool. So that was one.
That was 2005.
Okay, 2005. So yeah. And I thought that was pretty neat that, you know, getting to talk to him. The other one was when I first started working at The Fan at 97.1. We had something come up with Garber where the commissioner, you know what? It may not have been right when I first started working there. It might've been closer to the, it can't be MLS Cup. There was some reason that he wanted to come on our station. I don't know if it was just like start of the season, just to like hype up fans and talk to different markets, whatever it was. But anyway, I got to like interview him. But at the time, I was just a producer. I wasn't even, I don't think, fully on the air. But I was the only one there that really paid attention to MLS or knew enough to interview him. So they were like, well, why don't you do it and just put it on the website? Which at first I thought like, why do they want to put this on the – it's the commissioner of major – it's the commissioner of a sport in our country, but whatever. Yeah. Okay. So I did the interview. And we were going to post online. And the Crew just said, you know, make sure you let us know once it's recorded and done. And, you know, let us know that you posted it. I said, okay. So we recorded this interview, 10 minutes. I was kind of nervous, but I did the interview. And oh, by the way, this was all obviously pre you know, Save the Crew stuff, where I didn't know he was going to become our complete mortal enemy by that point. I knew he couldn't say Columbus Crew when he gives the MLS Cup to the Columbus Crew. But other than that, I didn't really have any ill feelings towards him. Did the whole interview, wrap it up. I go to hit save on our little computer program, and it's blinking like play or record is blinking, which means I didn't hit record.
Oh, no. Because
if I had hit it, it would have been lit up. It was just blinking at me like saying, I'm ready to record. I didn't hit the button. So, of course, I am completely mortified by this. So I messaged the crew and said, hey, I'm completely an idiot. I didn't get the interview. We talked for 10 minutes. Tell the commissioner we appreciate it. For whatever reason, this just I didn't hit the button and I didn't record it. I'm so sorry. Get a text back. The commissioner is willing to do the interview again.
Oh, wow.
And so he picks up the phone. So we call again, picks up the phone, and he said, well, I guess we had a mistake there, huh? And I said, yeah, we did. I'm really sorry about this. And he goes, no problem. It's fine. I've got a few minutes. And I said, okay. I said, I hate to do this, but I'm going to ask you the exact same questions. And he's like, no, that's fine. And then he proceeded to almost verbatim do the interview again. Like, the almost exact same answers to every question. And I thought, man, how rehearsed is this guy? Like, because usually, you know, like if we stopped this and said, hey, let's do that whole thing over again, I assume I would have somewhat different answers or slight variant. It was almost word for word. And that was the first time I thought, how much is he just got a line for everything?
Right.
And maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But so I have to give him credit that he came back and did this interview. But then it also struck me as like, why does the commissioner of Major League Soccer have enough time to do this stupid interview?
Yeah. Well, that shows you what all is happening at the Major League Soccer offices. That's funny, though. I imagine that you're not the first person to have accidentally not recorded a somewhat important interview with somebody. But
Well, it only happened once.
Good. I think when you do that once,
after that, I was like, every time, it's like, okay, I've hit record. I'm going to hit record on something else. I'm hitting record on my phone. I don't know what else I could hit record on, but I felt so stupid, and I should have. It was dumb.
When you brought up Save the Crew there, and I told you before we were going to touch on that, you obviously were, you know, I don't want to give you Morgan Hughes level credit, but you played your part. No. You played your part, obviously, with everything involving Save the Crew. You know, obviously, you were a Crew fan, so I imagine that's how you got involved. But when it comes to, you know, being not a figurehead, but, you know, you're someone people recognized as part of that movement. How did you kind of get started with that and more involved than the average person, I guess?
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember, obviously, like everyone, the night that Grant Wall's tweet came down, and, you know, that I saw it. I know there's like two camps with Crew fans, right? Where there's half the camp was the ones who woke up in the morning and found out and ruined their day that way. The other half was me. I was in the found out right before he went to bed camp and then didn't sleep all night and was like pissed off and frustrated. And like, but I ended up the next morning, I was just like, I got to go into work. And the luxury of working in a sports talk station is when your favorite team does something great, like the Buckeyes win a national championship, we get to talk about that all day long.
Right.
But when something like this happens, it's like, oh, now we got to talk about this terrible situation where the Crew are going to leave. And I just thought it was done. I'm like, what do you can't change that.
Right.
We've seen pro sports. We know how this works. I mean, you've covered, you know, all kinds of sports over your career. You know how it goes. There's once the wheels start turning, it's really hard to stop them. So I kind of went in with that, and I just, you know, laid into everyone I could think of about, you know, from the Hunt family to like, why did you sell to this idiot, to, you know, Precourt, to Don Garber, and, you know, whatever. Just, I'm done with the league. I'm done with everything. I'm done with that. Like, I'll never touch this league again. And so, but that night, when it all happened, I remember I was messaging, like I reached out to Sam and Patrick Golden and Lamakia, because again, those are the guys that like kind of was there with the start of Mass Report. And I just said, like, we got to get together. Like, tomorrow. I don't know if you guys can all swing it, but maybe we can go to a bar or something. Of course, you know, Hendox at the time, that was where we all naturally kind of gathered because it's where the podcasts have been done. And
right.
It was just our, that was like our water. I know some people had various different places they went. That was where we went. Some people went to Endeavor. But so I went there, and of course, I was fully planning on it's just going to be us hanging out, seeing each other, kind of for like, not one last time, but like one last time as crew fans of our team, and like, let's get this all out of our system, and let's vent. And we'll still be friends throughout life, you know, but we won't have this touchstone to come back to. You know, we'll do other things, but I won't see them at crew games much, you know. It'll be all, you know, just have to see them other places.
Yeah.
And that was where Morgan was. It was so jarring because everyone else there was just, you know, in tears or gallows humor at the best, you know, just, you know, nothing, you know, everybody was very, you know, nihilist Arby's kind of vibe. Just what is life? Life sucks. Eat Arby's, you know, whatever. Morgan was walking around like, you know, this aggression shall not stand. You know, it's like, whoa, what is that? What do you mean? It's, you know, and he was like, we're fighting. I'm fighting. There's a group of us. We're fighting. And I'm like, well, okay, well, tell me what you need. And I'm whatever we can do. I like to fight. I would much rather fight than just not like in life, but I'm saying when I see an injustice or something wrong, I would much rather rant about it, get in someone's face about it, try to fix it than to just say, well, what are you going to do? Life just sucks, you know? So that appealed to me. I'm sure it obviously appealed to thousands of crew fans. So I'm definitely not special in that regard, but it just so happened that, and I've said this to a lot of people who are like, oh, thanks for, you know, talking about this. Like if anybody else had a radio show and they were a crew fan in that time, they would have done the same thing. Like, it's just what you do. So, and fortunately everybody at the station, they were, you know, great about giving me time and space to do that, you know, because they could have just ignored it or said, ah, well, there's no chance. It's not happening.
Right.
You know, so they were very good about being supportive there. So I appreciate that from them. But yeah, I started out trying to help out with Save the Crew, and then I realized that these people are way more talented and smarter, eloquent, everything than I could ever hope to be. So I saw what they were doing and how good they were at it. And I thought, I'll stay over in my corner in my lane where I know what to do. I have this radio show. I will just try to update whenever I can, whatever they're doing. But I'm not gifted enough to do what they were doing. So the Save the Crew people were just so talented. And you see what they all do, a lot of them, for a living. I mean, they're all really great in their own professional careers. And, you know, the best and the brightest came through and helped us out. So it's great.
Am I remembering this correctly? Did you speak at the City Hall
thing? Yeah. Morgan asked me to speak there. And I was like, I don't know what I don't know what I'm going to say. But then I quickly, you know, I started finding out about some of the different things where I want to say when we got there that day, Morgan said, it may not have been Morgan. I don't want to put words in his mouth. One of the organizers there might have been like, again, I don't want to say people's names because I don't want to give somebody the wrong impression. But I know a few people, there was buzz from some of the organizers at the time that, like, word has gotten to some of the owners. Some of the owners aren't happy about this in Major League Soccer. I remember there being a very distinct rumor that, like, Drew Carey was going to, like, speak about it or tweet about it. Or, like, again, that was just one of the things that I don't think ever happened. But it was something that, like, somehow someone got a hold of him and he was like, this sucks. I'm a Browns fan. Yeah. We don't play with this. This is not cool. And so I remember that being a thing that, at least in my head, was like, well, shoot. You know, if there's a couple owners that hate this, the ownership is what gets to approve this or vote it down. So I thought, well, then that's good. That's all. Everybody was looking for a wedge, you know, just what's the little wedge that can crack the door open enough so that they can hear our voices. And then hopefully that can move it open further. And then we can all rush in and stop it, you know? So for me, that was the thing where I heard that. I'm like, well, if like Major League Soccer owners are pissed off about this, then we've got a chance. So then that was all I needed to just, okay, we're going to do this. It's going to work. And then it was, you know, it was a lot of that. I think I'm sure you saw the same thing where we would hear something. It's going this way. It's going this way. And then later it would be like, ah, that fell through.
Yeah.
Whatever thing we were hoping for, whatever thing was kind of making the back channel buzz, that didn't work out. But something else just came up, you know, and then something else comes up. And then, hey, there's this, you know, when the law was found, the ORC 967, you know, yeah. Like it was just everyone needed little life preservers and little breaths of air to kind of keep afloat until they started finding like, hey, there's a rowboat. Hey, there's an island. Hey, there's some flares. Hey, we can, you know, eventually flag somebody down and they can come rescue us. And that's what happens. So, but yeah, I do give a lot of credit to, cause I mean, I was completely, okay, it's just done. And I'm going to fight like hell to make sure Major League Soccer, like I was going to like be the biggest critic of Major League Soccer ever. and some would argue maybe I still am, but that was like my plan. That first night after it happened, I was like, I'm just going to try to do my best to shout down this league and promote every other league but MLS as a soccer fan. And then Morgan was like, hey, why don't we just try to save the team? And it's like, that's a better, I like that idea.
I'm good. Yeah. Was there a moment that stands out when you were like, oh man, this is really gonna happen? You know, I mean, you mentioned the kind of roller coaster ride that everyone sort of went through, but was there a time when you finally realized like, hey, there's a legitimate shot at this, or here's the path that we now have, yeah. or whatnot.
I'll tell you, like, he gets a lot of credit and he deserves it, but the work that guys like Keith Noss did, mm-hmm. to just dig up, like, hey, they said that the attendance sucked and they said this sucked and that sucked, and what are we going to do? Our hands are tied. We have to move. When he started digging out emails that were like, no, here's examples where they may have been purposefully gutting the things behind the scenes that eventually could lead to lower attendance. You know, they're purposefully scuttling the Hispanic outreach program. You know, those are the things where I started saying, wait, there's a lot more to this than just, ah, hey, attendance sucks. What are you going to do? So I would say, like, when I, you know, obviously the Modell law, that was a big one, but also just the work those guys did of digging up everything they could find and bringing those facts to light to say, look, there's some stuff here that maybe we need to look into or someone should look into. That I thought was very buoying, but I don't know if I probably have told this at some point. I know I have, but there was a moment where, it was right after a sad moment where Frankie Hayden got on social media and kind of lit up former employee of the crew.
Right.
And, you know, at the time it was like, so, you know, something we all don't, there's something about the change, you know, whatever. So I texted Morgan, probably not the most sensitive message in the world, but I texted Morgan Hughes and said, you know, Can you save the crew already so we can get Frankie to calm down? just something kind of BS-y and whatever, like, hey, why don't you get this done so that Frankie will just chill out? You know, whatever. Just something goofy to break the tension and whatever. And then he texted me back and said, remind me to tell you about the timing of this text message. And of course, then I'm like, what? What? What does that mean? He's like, I can't say anymore. And I'm like, so of course I'm like swearing. And so then that was, I think that was like a Wednesday. And I found out later that literally they had been either on the call or just gotten off the call, I think with Lyons, where Steve Lyons told him like, it's going to happen. It's done. Or, you know, done, not done, whatever. It's moving down the pathway. And I don't even know. It may not have been Steve Lyons. Don't put that, you know, whoever it was, someone they were talking to told them it's pretty official. And so then, that Friday morning, when it was Friday, right? I think when everything started breaking.
Yeah, when everyone ended up at Endeavor and yeah.
So that was when that morning where people were like, "We're going to Endeavor" and all this stuff. I like started texting him and I'm like, all caps, like, "Is this what you're referencing? Like, is this why you told me?" You know? And he's like, "Yeah, don't say anything, but it's done." And I'm like, "Okay." And so then, of course, trying to be journalistically integral on a story like that, as you can attest to, you don't want to just have one source. So then, of course, I'm sure you were doing the same thing. We're all like texting everyone we know who may have some influence. And it was a while ago that I had talked with someone in city government, actually county government, I'll say that. And so we had done an interview with someone in county government, and one of their like media handlers, the PR person for that entity, I got a message from him out of the blue that was like, "Hey, I've seen your tweets. This is real. It's happening. We were just told about it in some meeting. It's official." So then that's when I was like, okay, so this is happening. And then I like ran into the studio at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was like, guys, this is legit. And I think by then, like everyone kind of knew there was something, you know, right. Pretty real, but no one had seen the official MLS says it's done thing. But
yeah.
So then from that point, I was just like, all right, this is happening. It's, I don't know how or who, but it's happening.
Right. So. Yeah. That day was weird for me because, you know, stuff starts to come out and similar to you, I'm trying to find out things, but I was supposed to be at a wedding that night in Cincinnati and I had my girlfriend and I were going to drive down. It's a good friend of mine from college was getting married and I had three friends coming from Chicago that were going, we had a hotel. We were all going to stay there that night. We're going to get up the next morning because the next day Ohio State played Minnesota in football. And obviously I had to be back to cover that. And they already had tickets. So they were all coming, we're all coming back so they could go to the game. So this all starts to come out and I'm like, all right, well, I'm just going to go to Endeavor because that seems to be, you know, the place to be. And I can talk to people there and, you know, we'll see what comes out of it. So my girlfriend and I go over to Endeavor and you start to hear more and more people are showing up to Endeavor. And I'm like, I can't go down to Cincinnati tonight. Like, so I text the girl who's my friend who's getting married. And I was like, how much are you going to hate me if I don't come to your wedding? And she was like, what are you talking about? And I like explained and she didn't care at all about the crew. She's a big sports fan. So I was like trying to appeal to that side of things.
Right. Yeah.
And she just like stopped responding to my text messages. So my girlfriend and I were like, I was ready to call, like, just be like, you know what? Nicole will forgive me. Like eventually, like I'll explain it. Sarah was like, no, like we have to go to this. Like, how about we go and we'll just come back and like, we can come back. We can go at least be there for the ceremony and the beginning, you know, like say hello and then come.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So we left Endeavor. I think we already had like our clothes in the car. So we like changed in the car. I remember. And the whole time we were listening to you guys on the drive down there. I remember that. And you know, I'm writing stuff and calling people and like talking to Andrew Erickson, who was the dispatch writer at the time. And we're seeing what each other had heard. And, so I get a story up and we're ready for, I think while we're driving is when the official like announcement came and,
yeah.
And, but yeah, we get down there to the wedding and the people that had come in from Chicago, I told them like, look, I'm going back. And they were just like, what are you talking about? Like they understood that this was a big deal, but like, you know, they were like, she's getting married, which I understand. But in the end, we stayed for a decent amount of the reception, but we did come back. The whole group came back that night and we went to Endeavor. And this was, we probably can get back to like 11 p.m. And there were still a good amount of people there. And actually two of my good friends had been there during once they got done with work. And I like texted them and I was like, are you guys still there? And they were like, no, but we'll come back. And so they just like showed back up at Endeavor.
Yeah.
And that was that day will always be I'll always remember just how crazy, you know, Cincinnati and back and all that was that day.
I just remember that day felt like, cause I got there, our show ended at 6 and then mm-hmm. I was there at 6:15 as soon as I could get there. And it just felt like, I mean, I never did a ton of these, but I remember once in high school, there was like a play that I had a very small part in. I might have even just been helping with the set building. I did something with it. This is, again, how much I paid attention to my high school years. But I remember like going to like the little get together afterwards for like the people who helped out with the play. Yeah. And it was just like
rap part
everyone's, even people you didn't like or didn't know that well or didn't matter that you didn't know them. Everybody was like best friends because it's like, we just went through this thing and it's finished, you know?
Yeah.
that was the vibe. It was just like an after party of a big production. Not that it was a production. It obviously was a huge effort. And and my perspective is different probably than the people who were working 20-hour days to, you know, do this stuff. But that's what it felt like to me. It was just like, oh, look, it's a reunion of all these people I love and got to see them all again. Josh Williams was there.
Yeah.
I don't even know if he wasn't, I don't know if he was supposed to be or not, but.
No, he definitely wasn't.
I've met Josh like maybe twice, you know, prior to that, but you know, I'm obviously familiar with him and all that. And I walked through the doors and it just happened to be, he was sitting right by the door and he looked at me and he's like, "Hey," and I'm like, "Hey, what are you doing here?" You know? And it was that all night of just, "Hey, you're here. I can't believe it. Can you believe this is happening?" And everyone's response was, "No, can't believe this is what we're seeing." But it's great.
There were a handful of guys throughout that season. You know, obviously everyone was aware of it and whatnot, and you know, but I think, and I'm not going to name names, there were some guys who were just like, you know, if I have to move, I have to move. I'm a professional soccer player. That happens.
Right.
There were other guys that were consistently coming up to us after practice. You know, some guys like weekly about like, "Hey, you know, what have you guys heard?" You know, talking to Andrew and I, and you know, just clearly concerned about that and not wanting to leave Columbus. And you know, Josh was obvious, and this makes sense. This shouldn't surprise anyone because he's an Ohio guy and whatnot. But Josh was one of those guys that was like, you know, if you know, had things gone the opposite direction, it would have been very interesting to see what Josh Williams did, because I do not imagine he and a select number of other guys would have played for that Austin team. I'll say that. But yeah, Josh was always very interested in what we'd heard, you know, and not that they heard much, but he was always willing to, you know, talk about that stuff and clearly wanted to be in Columbus. And so it did not surprise me when I found out Josh showed up after practice to Endeavor.
Yeah, no, it was pretty neat. It was surreal though too. Cause yeah, like Andrew Erickson was there and everybody's like high fiving him and congratulating him. He's like, thanks. Like I'm still reporting. Like I'm trying, you know, it's a weird spot for a journalist. I'm sure you can relate.
Yeah.
Where like people are high-fiving him and congratulating him. He's like, "Yes, I'm happy. This is good."
Yeah. You know, well, and privately,
of course, he was very, you know, happy that this occurred, but he had a job to do.
Right. You know? And Andrew, you know, that year, you know, he's, for people who don't know, is now works in DC and works for a university for the alumni magazine there. So he's still writing, but that year I think took so much out of him. Not only, you know, you're covering the team and the regular grind that comes with that, but then, you know, he's trying to figure out stuff down in Austin, staying up late to listen to city council meetings. And, you know, it was about as taxing of a year as he had as a professional. And, you know, I've said to him a few times, and I don't know if he would admit it, but I do think maybe if he'd, you know, if that had just been a normal year, he might still be in sports journalism. But the stuff that he was required to do and the stuff he wanted to do because he wanted to get the right information to people was a lot.
Yeah. I think to your question about what were some other things that made you feel like it could happen? I think it was when Leslie Poole was like, you know, dressing down Anthony Precourt and Richard Suttle in those meetings, some of which you're right. They were like 1 a.m. They were still going on. And I just remember having that same conversation with lots of other crew fans of like, why are we sitting up watching a city council meeting for a city we will never probably most of us live in, but we're up here watching? And the answer is because that's how much, you know, the crew means to us. And I don't know, I think between that whole scenario and then last year was just kind of the exhale from that scenario, right? Where we were all just kind of like, okay, they're here, they're going to stay. We'll get the mojo moving again for the following seasons. There's lots of things to eventually be excited about. And but at least for me, it was like, I'm just glad to have games to go to. If they lose 7-0 every time, I wouldn't be happy about it, but whatever. They're not taking my team away. That's the good news.
Right.
So between that and now this situation, which again, totally different, I don't think I'll ever look at the crew the same way as I did before,
right?
You know, where I'm sure other crew fans can admit to this too. There are times in your life where you're like, yeah, I don't know. Do I need to go to that game? Or do I, you know, people have plans, life comes up. I'm not saying you're back to every game. Obviously not everybody can. But for those of us who have like season tickets, there have been games where it's like, well, maybe I could, maybe I'll just blow that one off and go to the next one, you know, that's a bigger opponent or something. And I think between these last couple, that situation and this one, I don't think I'll ever take a crew game for granted. Just because they're so precious to get to go to this stuff. And if you really care about, you know, whatever sports team, it's not just the crew, but, you know, whatever your passion, I think this is going to reset a lot of people in life, just whatever you're passionate about.
Yeah.
You know, why wait? Go do it.
You know, especially don't, if,
let, don't let stuff get in the way.
Yeah, especially if that passion isn't something you can do sitting in your home, which
exactly right.
If you like to paint a lot, you've probably had plenty of time to do that.
You're like unaffected by this.
Yeah.
You're someone who just really loves rearranging your own furniture. This has been your year. But yeah, outside of that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to get you out a couple quick hitting questions. First one, favorite crew player of all time.
I know it's an obvious answer. Well, I'll give you two.
Okay.
The main, like, for me, the no-brainer guy is Guillermo. Just, I mean, again, that there's just something about watching him play soccer that I've rarely experienced with any other soccer player. The combination of talent, you know, grit, determination, all that stuff, but also just the ability to make the plays in the biggest moments. I will never forget that. But another guy from that same team that I really loved and I think was just severely underappreciated by the league is good old number 12, Eddie Gavin, whose time with, you know, MLS was cut too short. But that's kind of why I think I liked him, was just because he just did not give two craps about all the hype and all the crazy things that you see people get caught up in pro sports. He was just there to go out, play, have fun. Really good player, box-to-box midfielder, did the dirty work, and, you know, wasn't the flashiest guy, but I really loved his game. And so, yeah, Eddie Gavin for me. And then he just, like, one day is like, I don't want to do this anymore. I'll go coach at a small Catholic school somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and good for him.
When we were talking last week with Patrick, Eddie Gavin came up for some reason, and I pointed out he also has a great beard.
Oh yeah,
for people who can't
see, Eddie Gavin right there.
Yeah, my I haven't shaved during this coronavirus, and my beard. And I said this on the last show. My beard grows in red despite my hair not being red. And before the 2008 MLS Cup, they had like a rally at out at Easton, and before the like run, and I was there, and he's just standing there, and I went up to talk to him, and he literally like just discussed red facial hair for like 5 minutes. He was like, yeah, he's like, you know, it could be worse and, you know, stuff like that. And I was like, yeah, you know, I was like, it's really weird that it doesn't match my hair, but he was like, yeah, whatever. He's like, you're part of an elite club and things like that, which was a funny conversation to have.
And this is not to toot my other project things that I've done, but if anybody hasn't listened to the Cup podcast that we did about the 2008 team,
which
I'm very passionate about, Steve Cirque tells a great story on that podcast about how Eddie Gavin had this game he would play where whatever was in your hand, if it was a water bottle or a clipboard or, you know, whatever, if you're walking around with it, if he could walk up behind you and knock it out of your hand, he got to punch you. But if he tried to do it and you held on to it, then you got to punch him. And this was like his favorite game to play. And it's just so against what you think of if you remember him and you think of him just this quiet, unassuming guy. But then you remember that, I mean, he came into the league as what, a 17-year-old, 16-year-old? Really young. I think 17, I'm going to say, for the Red Bulls. And, you know, so he was a teenager when he got into the league. Who knows if like he'd been able to kind of grow up like a normal kid and then get into the league, you know? But
yeah,
16, I know that's not that old or that young to get into soccer to be playing professionally. Obviously, you look around the world and that's pretty regular. But in MLS, that was certainly, you know, not the norm of the, you know, back then.
He was 16 years and 2 months, and at the time, that was the youngest player. Freddie Adu, obviously, is the youngest player, but. Yeah. Yeah, and it's funny you said his career was cut short. He played 11 seasons.
Well, I know, right. Yeah, like he had a full career, but as a Crew fan, I assumed Eddie Gavin's going to have every record when it came to minutes, games. You know, he'd probably be up in the top five in assists or something just because of longevity, you know.
Yeah, I think he retired at like 28. I mean, I think, you know, obviously he had
Plenty in the tank.
Yeah.
I thought he was going to be playing. Well, what year does it say there? What year he what year he played?
2013 was his last year.
No, but what year did he start?
Oh, 2003.
Yeah, okay. So 13, he was 28.
He was drafted 12th overall, which is ironic because that was his number.
So he's 35 now?
33 now.
Eddie Gavin could be like bossing
all
over. Who knows? Or he could be gone. We could have, traded him. That's what I'm saying. Like that's a guy that, like I said, I enjoyed watching him play. So it also is kind of, it's nice, I guess, for me because I kind of like the what if scenarios and he's the perfect. What if he just kept playing? What if he was playing in 2015? You know, well, they have, got it done.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And it would have been interesting, Eddie Gavin's style of play, that like almost lethargic but effective style of play in a Greg Berhalter system. Greg and Eddie was a guy who, really understood the game and really worked on things. And I think working with a tactician like Greg, I'm sure Greg would have found ways to, get him in certain spots and things. It could have been very interesting. You're right.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, obviously they had this guy, Federico Higuain, who was playing around. Like, they had a lot of different pieces in that midfield that could have been interesting. But, yeah, I think Eddie and Higuain played like a year or two together, right? I want to say Higuain came in 2012.
Yeah, that sounds right. I think that was the year Eddie got hurt, so they probably didn't play a ton.
Oh, yeah, right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah, stupid Open Cup game.
Right.
God. Right, so anyway. Yeah, those are – I don't know. He was one of my favorites. And I apologize that I'll just be one of these people forever that's 2008 apologist. But that – again, people may not know. Like, went to Toronto with that team just as a fan. Frankie and Gino took over the bar at the team hotel, which, by the way, was the Rogers Center, a.k.a. the Sky Dome. That was the hotel that the Crew put the fans in. And it's also where the players were staying. We didn't know that. And then we went down to the restaurant that was in the place before everybody went out for the evening. And those guys were down there with the Trillium Cup, filling it up with beer and passing it around to fans. I mean, it's just, right? Like, that's not a thing that you would expect to have happen. So,
right.
Yeah. So I have, as you can tell, a bit of an affinity for that team. So sorry to be 08-centric.
That's all right. I think most people who were around and even some that weren't would agree with that. Speaking of that team, my next question for you was, where did you watch the final game?
Oh, so I know where you watched it because you're on the DVD all the time. Or on the broadcast when they've been rebroadcasting.
Yeah.
So that's good. I wanted to be where you were in the SoCal Nordica, but I didn't – well, I wasn't going to go to the game anyway, but as it turned out, I was sitting at home with the flu.
Ooh.
And it was like I was sicker than I'd been in a long time. And I remember watching that game with blankets around me and like shivering because I had a fever, but I was in like a recliner watching that game and happy and excited. But just like kind of sad that I wasn't there. But ultimately, it's a good thing because if I'd have gotten to that game and then felt like that, it would have been – there's no way I could have gone into the game feeling like that. So, yeah, but that was – so I was just watching at home in Columbus. Right. But, yeah.
And this one's a little off the wall. I got this from – I don't know if you saw this on Twitter the other day. Katie Nolan from ESPN.
Yeah.
Started like a Zoom thing where they tried to get the most famous person to show up on the Zoom chat.
I saw that. I thought that was so great.
If you, and this doesn't have to be Crew related, who is the most famous person you think you could text or even DM if you don't have their number that you might be able to get in a situation like that?
It's very interesting. I mean, in part, like, so, okay, so we work, you know, at the Fan, I work with, I could text Spielman.
Yeah.
I could text James Laurinaitis because I've worked with those guys. And I mean, they're famous because of their NFL careers. And so they're pretty well known in that regard.
Yeah.
They're certainly well known around Ohio State. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else. Like, and again, like, you know, I don't want to shortchange anybody. Like Krenzel, very famous to us as Buckeye fans. Would he be as famous as, say, James Laurinaitis to the national audience? I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe. You know, but yeah, and like, you know, Rimmer. Jason Stark has probably got a decent amount of people who know who he is because of what he does for a living, you know, writing baseball stories. Yeah, that's a really good question. I'd say those are some of the names that I know I could text. I've got, the sad thing is I've got other people's names and numbers, but they're just like professionally one time 7 years ago, we messaged about them maybe coming on a radio show.
And, right.
There's no way I could say it now if I texted them like, hey, jump on this thing. They'd be like, who is this that's texting me? So I'm trying to think who, I mean, well, honestly too, I mean, for soccer fans, obviously Frankie's pretty, you know, like the thing I always lose perspective on is if you said Frankie Hayek in Germany, there's a large number of people who would know who you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, and even, you know, nationally in the US, just because of what he did with the national team and, played with the Galaxy too, and played in Tampa, I think, at the beginning of his career.
Yeah, yeah, played for the Muni.
Yep. Yeah,
that was short hair Frankie.
Yes, it was.
That's the if you watch that 2002 those highlights, and there's at least one full game from the 2002 World Cup with the U.S. lost to Germany, which of course has the controversial ball going over the line and or hitting a German player's arm.
Yeah.
And neither one getting called because there was no VAR, of course, back then. But that game is in HD on YouTube. You can go find just the full game in HD. And Frankie's playing for the U.S. in that game. And you're like, who's this? Oh, that's Frankie with short hair. Weird.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny to think about. All right, well, that's all I got for you. I appreciate you coming on. I hope that people found this entertaining. We're really, you know, without soccer, without live sports, we're just trying to, you know, do some of these to give people something to listen to where, you know, maybe a little bit off the wall, maybe a little bit different, but, you know, it's something that maybe an hour or so of your day, you don't think about the fact that we're trapped inside our houses. Or as I just saw recently, if you're Ezekiel Elliott and Dak Prescott, having parties in Dallas, and not paying attention to any of this. So, you know, teach their own, I guess.
Good job, guys. Way to go.
For the people that are social distancing and doing what we're supposed to, I hope this helps. I thought you were great. I appreciate it.
Hey, and, anytime. Love coming on. Thanks again.
Yeah, hopefully the next time we have you on, we're talking actual games and, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah, I know. Hopefully so. And to everyone listening, I hope you all are staying safe and, you know, flattening the curve and all that stuff, and we'll get through this, and we'll get back to crew games soon, and we'll all enjoy tailgating, or even if we have to watch it on Zoom, like
whatever at this point, right?
Yeah, however we have to get a game back, I'll stay away from the stadium if it means they can start playing again. Whatever they need us to do, even if they just want me to stay away, that's fine. I will personally leave just so that the rest of everybody can watch the game. So.
All right, well, Sam and I should be back. Sam was busy today, so I had to figure out how to do this by myself. Sam and I should be back hopefully next week. We're working with – there's a couple people we're talking to try and get on, but we're staying in the same vein of what we've done. So check back. I hope you guys enjoyed it, and we'll talk to you soon.